Our next case is 14-601, James P. Kuhn versus Kelly L. Kuhn, now known as Cottle. Ms. Mitchell?
Good morning. Thank you, Chief Justice O'Connor. May it please the court, I would ask to reserve 5 minutes of my time for any possible rebuttal. Your Honors, I suspect that in this case, that absent the oil and gas issues and the leasing issues that are involved, that I probably wouldn't be standing here in front of you today, because most of the issues really in this case aren't all that novel. We have issues that involved the division of property in a divorce case, determination and identification of marital versus non-marital property, transmutation of property, and active versus passive income. Obviously, clearly those are things that are all addressed by statute, particularly 3105.171, and issues that have been dealt with by this court and many other courts throughout the state and on many occasions.
Counsel, when it comes to terminating a marriage and determining what the outcome should be from an economic standpoint, I guess I tend to think that the rules that we have, court and some from the legislature, are there to assist the judges in a reasonable outcome, a fair outcome, rather than it's all black and white. Am I wrong in that regard?
No, I don't believe so at all, Your Honor. And I believe that many cases have indicated and stated that trial courts do have broad discretion in making determinations in domestic relations cases for that very reason.
Well, did the trial court here think it had discretion with respect to the signing bonus?
Yes, I believe so. And I believe that the trial court reviewed the statutes and the applicable case law, and given the various factors in this case and the facts in this case, the trial court determined that the signing bonus itself was a passive income that was generated from what was determined to be the non-marital property of the appellant, that hot road property that he had owned prior to the marriage. And given the trial court's findings, the trial court magistrate did make extensive findings of fact and conclusions of law regarding the various testimony and evidence that had been presented, she determined that no transmutation had occurred regarding that particular piece of property, and such it remained the separate property of the appellant.
And that's the part that the Court of Appeals disagreed on.
Actually, that part of the decision that the Court of Appeals affirmed. And so they then determined that any future royalties or payments from that oil and gas lease would remain the property of the appellant. It was with the signing bonus, the check for the $121,000, that the disagreement came. And I guess of a particular concern to the appellant here and for future purposes is in the, not in the lead opinion, but in the concurring opinion, there's a sentence, a line that indicates that by appellant including his wife on that lease, that he intended to make her a party to the lease as well. And I believe that the evidence that was presented in the case indicated just the opposite, that there was no intention that she was to be a party to the lease, but that her presence was required, her signature was required by the leasing company in order to effectuate the lease, because she had some potential to have a dower interest at some point in the future. And the concern becomes then, if by having the spouse sign the lease because of that interest at the request and requirement of the leasing company.
Well, if you're married, you can't do much of anything involving real estate without both signatures.
That's absolutely correct.
I mean, you can try, but you're not going to get the job done, right?
That's correct, yes. Yes.
So her participation was required in negotiating, agreeing to the lease and the bonus.
Yes.
Correct?
Yes. Yes, and I would agree with that.
I mean, he wasn't going to get a nickel. Unless she signed.
That's correct. Right. Because of the fact that they were married, without her signature, the leasing company wasn't going to effectuate the lease with them. But the reality remains that that did not create for her a separate property interest, and even the appellate court agreed with that. Her signing the lease didn't ultimately give her a separate property interest. However, by then allotting her one half of that signing bonus, they've almost created that result.
How was the check drawn?
The check was written to both of them.
And how do you think royalty checks would be drawn if they hadn't gotten divorced?
Royalty checks probably would be written to both of them as well. Just knowing how the oil and gas companies generally operate, that was typically how those would come issued. However,
so she was going to get, according to the Court of Appeals now, she's getting one half of the signing bonus, the 121, and he was willing to give her $10,000 of that signing bonus, right?
The $10,000 was an agreement that they had reached to pay her, reimburse her for the money she had paid previously.
The $80,000 that she paid up to get him out of debt originally.
Correct.
Okay.
Yes.
And then she doesn't, according to the Court of Appeals, she does not get royalties.
That's correct.
Now, what are the royalties on this?
The royalties are potentially 20%. As my understanding, as of now, there's been no drilling on the property, therefore there are no royalties. That's a potential in the future, but as of right now, there
isn't. So we're here just arguing over one half of $121,000.
That's correct.
All right. Is the legal issue for us whether or not this is passive income or active income?
I believe so, because, again,
Is that just a routine determination for a trial court to make?
And Your Honor, that's why I started the way that I did, because I do believe many of the issues here are relatively routine. The trial court did find that, first of all...
So should we just improv this case, then?
I'm sorry?
Should we just improv this case?
No, I don't believe so. I believe it was proper for the court to take it, because I do believe there's a wider reaching issue here.
You want us to decide it.
I absolutely want you to decide
below,
it, yes.
Right?
Yes.
Otherwise, it's a routine case.
Right. There's a potential for wider reaching issues here, again, with that creation of an interest to the spouse by mandating and requiring that she sign. And again, in the concurring opinion.
I mean, this could be disposed of you're claiming it's an abuse of discretion, correct? On behalf of the trial court?
No, Your Honor. We agreed with the trial court's decision. The trial court found that the property was his separate property and that the income, that $121,000 check, was a passive income created or generated from that separate property. We agreed with the trial court opinion.
So the Court of Appeals looks at it and says this is, she's entitled to half of it.
Correct.
All right. So, I mean, the way to possibly handle this is just... improv it and say that it's not to be cited, then we don't have the far-reaching effect that you're talking about. The facts dictate the outcome of this case and tie it up, put it in a box, and nobody touches it again.
I guess that is one potential outcome. However, I do also believe that the appellate court was in error, and their decision is contradictory when you look at it in and of itself, because...
Are facts disputed as to whether or not she attended any meetings or negotiated the lease herself or researched titles or had any role in active as opposed to passive income?
Well, I don't believe there's any dispute that she was involved in the activities that led up to the signing of the lease. However, and there's some information within the briefs that she did attend the meetings with the appellant. She had gone to the recorder's office to pull the deeds and things like that.
All of that seems to go to the generation of the lease, which would generate income. But the signing bonus is something that seems like it's just an extra. And well, we analogize to the sports world, for example, because you are so good, we're just going to give you $1 million if you sign.
Well, and
not for anything you've done, just for who you are or just the nature of it.
And I guess from our position, whatever either of the parties did, whether it was the appellant or the appellee, as far as attending those meetings, going to the recorder's office, those types of things, the reason the lease came into existence was because of the appellant's ownership of this property in the area where the Utica Shale development all of a sudden exploded. If he hadn't owned that property, if he hadn't owned those mineral rights, they could have attended as many meetings as they wanted to attend. They have nothing to lease.
Counsel,
they have nothing
of any interest. I guess that's where I'm having trouble with the Court of Appeals here. They found the lease to be marital property. the lease itself to be marital property. It's divisible as a separate award. And then they say because no transmutation occurred, it stops being marital property. Why?
The property began, was originally his separate property.
He
owned it before they were married. Because they were able to trace all the monies that she had paid towards that property and was then reimbursed for them, any contribution she had made to the property was recovered by her, and that eliminated any issues of transmutation. At that point, then I don't believe the property becomes, or the lease becomes, a separate or a marital property. And by finding that he's entitled to the future royalties, I think that's ultimately the decision that was reached there. It was only that signing bonus that they found to be income, ignoring the passive versus active income.
So I guess in answer to the chief and to Justice Pfeiffer, you want us to write that a lease that's entered into during marriage is not a lease that belongs to the people it belongs and runs with the land.
Yes.
Only.
Yes. I don't believe by signing the lease that, just as the spouse of the appellant, that the appellee created an interest for herself in that property.
What about her
dowry?
It doesn't say that here, does it?
Right.
It just says that she is entitled to half of the signing bonus. She's not entitled to the lease.
That's correct. In the concurring opinion, there is language that suggests that he intended to or created in her a separate interest or an individual interest.
So I guess what you're saying, though, is if we follow that path, you want us to say that on divorce, the lease that you signed during the marriage is not your lease. Doesn't belong to the person who signed on the dotted line. When they get divorced, they no longer have an interest in that lease.
I believe it belongs to whoever retains the property, unless there's an agreement that both parties will retain an ownership in the lease as well, or a benefit from the lease.
Wasn't it that her signature was required because of the dower interest? Isn't that what we're talking about?
That's correct,
here?
Yes.
So
yes.
Your Proposition 3, as stated, that the signature procured solely to acknowledge the spouse's dower interest doesn't create an ownership interest in the real estate or benefits obtained, which would be the signing bonus. Is that what you're suggesting? And
yes.
That's where the idea of this being a general interest case may come into play.
Yes. Yes, and I believe that the proposition of law number 3 that was presented, I believe, is the most compelling here.
If the property had been jointly owned, let's say, or she had an actual interest that was transferred to her by deed, mm-hmm. we'd have a different story.
Oh, absolutely. I don't think we would be here. If the property had been transferred to her by deed, wouldn't be standing here, because there would be a written proof and intention that he intended to transfer partial ownership to her.
Companies are looking at couples and saying both of you must sign this lease, mainly because of the dower interest.
Yes.
That's what they're most concerned about.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Counsel, I come back to where I started. It seems to me in domestic relations we're talking about equity and fairness, and whether you want to try and shoehorn something into whether it's passive or not passive, it strikes me is that what the Court of Appeals was doing was looking at this and concluding what the trial court did just wasn't reasonable or fair. And you know, you concede the wife did a lot of the spade work in terms of figuring out what other people are getting for these leases, what we have, how to value it. For all we know, she was the tough one in the bargain that drove the price to what it was, and her signature's required. The check comes, and a month later, he's down at the courthouse trying to get divorced. Strikes me that really what the Court of Appeals was doing was looking at this and weighing the equities and the fairness.
And
whatever name we want to apply to it, that was
that's their outcome. It says if they ever put a well down and she's gone, he gets the royalties. But the bonus, she's so mixed up in it that half of it ought to go to her.
Mm-hmm. And that may be, Your Honor. In Proposition Law Number 4, I had indicated there's no information, there's no statement within the appellate court's decision indicating that the trial court abused its discretion. And I believe that's the standard that they were required to use, and that's just not in there. As far as those other factors, as far as, you know, what the appellee did to effectuate this lease, there is information within the original, you know, the original trial transcript of the things that she did. Whether that made an impact on how much they received for the signing bonus or, you know, the terms of the lease or so forth, I don't know at this point. And then the filing for divorce, I believe there's information in the original transcript about that as well, that the appellant indicated he filed for divorce because appellee had indicated to him she wanted out. So, you know, whether this was a balancing of fairness, which I do understand obviously is part of domestic relations practice, but I believe through the trial court's decision, the magistrate was, you know, tried very hard to balance all those things and went through with very meticulous findings of fact and conclusions of law as to the properties and so forth. Thank you.
Mr. Fox.
Chief Justice O'Connor, Justices of the Supreme Court, Ms. Mitchell. I will start by saying, first of all, it's an honor to be here today. After 25 years, the moment is not lost on me. Having said that, I never thought I'd be here on an oil and gas issue in a divorce case. But I would agree with a couple things that have already been stated. I would agree with Ms. Mitchell that, in fact, we probably wouldn't be here if it wasn't an oil and gas issue per se. And Justice Pfeiffer, I would agree with you that, quite frankly, it's a property division issue. I had indicated in my brief in opposition to jurisdiction that I think that's all that we were deciding in this issue. I understand that we have this great public interest in the oil and gas business that's hit Ohio, but even since the time of the filing of this divorce, which I wasn't on this case initially, it's waned. Nobody's drilling, nobody's digging, nobody's pulling a whole lot out anymore. These things come and go. And from domestic relations standpoint purposes, we always take a snapshot in time of what any particular piece of property is or looks like or comprises during the time of a divorce.
Was this marital property or separate property? Or was there
What's
a determination by the court on that?
We had so much property in this case. Are you referring to the signing bonus, Your Honor?
I'm referring to the property involved, which is the subject of the lease.
And I think some of the confusion, if I could answer your question, is because trial counsel and I had a very good working professional relationship, and we had narrowed the issues down in this case to essentially the oil and gas issues. We briefed that in the brief, and I think the evidence is clear. So when you ask the question, was this property marital? At the time the signing bonus came in, and there's no divorce filed, not only is it marital, there's a great argument to be made that my client, Ms. Cottle, owned a substantially more or higher equitable share of that property than Mr. Kuhn could ever claim. I think the evidence is clear, and I would, as we're going through this argument, I would refer the court to 3105.171H, which in and of itself codifies the thought that title to property is not dispositive of ownership.
He owned it before they were married.
He had title to it.
All right.
For domestic relations purposes, I'm sorry if you were going to follow up.
No. I'm trying to clarify the subject of the property. It belonged to him before he was married.
And when we used
say that would be his separate property, although she paid the mortgage off on it, which complicated it. Did the court make a determination it was marital or separate, or did it rule on that?
It was not an issue because we essentially stipulated that we were going to argue the oil and gas issues. But as with any case that involves a marital residence, there's three situations that could arise. He could maintain the residence and buy her out. She could maintain the residence and buy his comparatively meager investment in the property out. Or they could sell it, and they would each get their proportionate share out of the marital property.
But, counsel, all of those scenarios you describe are ignoring Justice O'Donnell's question. Did the trial court say, we've got Black Acre here that we built a house on that the wife contributed substantial money to the mortgage, correct?
The court did not say that. We stipulated
to
that.
I said that. I said that. What I'm saying is, did the court ever make a determination that this property has somehow become marital property by virtue of the actions of the parties during the coverture of marriage?
I don't think any decision was made relative to that. It's very hard to explain.
Isn't that a problem when, therefore, the Court of Appeals says, well, he's always owned this property and there seems to be a $1 million lease on it, so it's his?
The trial court said that, essentially, gave him the signing bonus and the royalties. The Court of Appeals disagreed. The Court of Appeals specifically said the trial court erred and that the signing bonus should be split. Now, interestingly, and one of the things I was going to say earlier before Justice Pfeiffer started questioning counsel, and counsel had discussed the issue of these oil and gas issues, is that, quite frankly, from my point of view, I don't care what the court calls it. She clearly is entitled to at least one half of the signing bonus, and I say it for several reasons. The lead opinion at the Court of Appeals basically said, look, I'm going to look at this exactly like we start on a premise of any case that's a divorce. This is income received during the marriage, payable to both parties, put in a joint bank account. That's argument one. As a premise, any income received to either party during marriage
is there. But counsel does not intellectually follow, therefore, if she's entitled to half the signing bonus, isn't she therefore entitled to half the future royalties?
You bring up some attorney-client discussions that occur as we go through the appellate process. My client discussed with my client the opportunity to appeal certain issues, and we are here today with the issues that we're on. If you want to know some arguments both ways on the royalties, I would tell you there is no disclaimer of she's signing only for her dower interests. Now, that may seem a distinction without a difference, but I would point out to counsel that we frequently in the domestic relations realm, when we're going through a divorce, someone will leave the marriage, we're not divorced yet, and they will buy a home. And the bank wants the wife to sign off. And in that signature line, she will sign off, I'm signing away my dower rights as a result of signing this document. You will find no such language in either the memorandum of oil and gas lease that the parties both signed. You will find no such language in the option to lease that the parties both signed. And you will find no such language in the 30-some-odd pages in the lease itself. They are always referred to jointly as either grantor or lessor. So if you want my opinion on what we could have done, yes, I think there could have been the opportunity to pursue perhaps some royalty issues. I would go one step further. Many instances when we talk about premarital investment in marital property, when you look at what my client invested in that marital property, I don't care who it's titled to, because that's what we talk about with domestic relations cases. You know, it's not a car. If it's a car and you're talking about a criminal case and I'm driving a car in my wife's name and she comes and takes it and I don't know about it, she can't be accused of theft. But if I bought that car and just happened to put it in her name, if we were to divorce, then that car is mine if I bought it with separate property. So let's go back to the marital. Let's go back to the marital property of the residence here. My client, on literally days before the eve of marriage in May of 2007, she takes a CD of $80,000 and pays down the mortgage, far more than he ever paid on that house. Then he had taken out a home equity line of credit.
Counsel, isn't that really at the heart of this case? Again, back to Justice O'Donnell's question. Just based upon what you just said there, how can we be talking about separate property of the real estate if the trial court has never made that determination one way or another?
Well, I think they implicitly made it in some way at the trial court level. I mean, you have to read the decision. This is one of those things where the magistrate made significant findings in this case, which we disagreed with some of it, obviously, and that's why we went to the Court of Appeals. But it's one of those situations where the judge took a review of it and put a one-page acceptance of it and filed it, and we appealed from that. There was no, here's the confusion. We could have tried this case for 2.5 days. That's what we were scheduled for. Instead, we took a lot of those issues out of play. We knew that once whoever was going to take that house was going to take that house had to pay the other person. If my client was going to take that house, she would have had to pay him $21,000 plus $23,500 for part of the pay down during the marriage. And that was his share. He, in fact, had to pay her significantly more than that because he decided to keep the house. We reserved the issues to argue those premarital contributions to the house as it relates to the signing bonus and the royalties. I guess, and I hope I'm understanding Justice Pfeiffer correctly, Justice O'Neill, but the reality is my interpretation of this is that the Court of Appeals reviewed what the trial court did and found it to be an error and decided that she's entitled to half of the signing bonus. And as Justice Pfeiffer indicated, you know, we do deal sort of with a court of equity in domestic relations court. We have codified it. But in fact, part of the statute indicates that the division is to be essentially fair and equitable. We have a woman, my client in this case, who invested well over $100,000 if you include the marital pay down on the joint mortgage the parties took out during the marriage, plus her premarital investment. I think a solid argument could be made, as I said in my brief, that she should get 73.5%.
Let me ask you a different question, Mr. Fox. We're talking about a signing bonus to a lease. So signing bonus wouldn't have any interest in the realty in any event. It's just an extra payment as an inducement to sign.
Well, I think that's correct.
How do we characterize a signing bonus? Is it it's not an interest running with the land, is it?
Well, I would suggest, no. No, I would suggest what the Court of Appeals did was accurate with respect to that signing bonus. It's income received during the marriage. And let me flesh out
real— Is it passive income or is it active income in your view?
Well, I think it's income. I think it's income generated as a result of the marriage and the investment of the parties in the marriage. But I also think it can be—
Characterize it as active or passive?
I characterized it as active in one part of my brief. And I will suggest this to you why. It's active because if they don't do anything, they don't get any money. There's a lot of people down there, not many anymore, but there's a lot of people down there that aren't leasing out their property. So if they sit on their hands and do nothing, there is no money. That's one. Two, if during this process, and there's no dispute that they went to countless meetings, even appellant admitted that during the trial of this limited issue. And further, as was pointed out by counsel, my client was asked by appellant, go down on your free— she's a sheriff's deputy, she has certain days off during the week that other people don't— go down during work hours or during public office hours and go to the recorder's office. She went on several occasions to do title searches. Further, both parties entered into, negotiated a lease before the lease that's the subject of this litigation was involved. They both entered into it. And they had not had a notary available to them at the time that lease was entered into. And they realized and found out a couple days later they could get a better price. They both decided to back out, sign the new lease that gave them $5,000 an acre, and move on. When you talk about the equity of the city, first of all, that's the active argument, if you ask me, Justice O'Donnell, that they did, in fact, engender efforts together to go ahead and produce the signing bonus that resulted.
So a signing bonus is active income in your view?
Well, I think so. I think it can be simply income as the Court of Appeals found it, and I think it can be active income based on the conduct of the parties in this instance.
Counsel, you had said at some point earlier that the Court of Appeals looked at the situation differently than the trial court. I think that was part of your argument earlier. How does that translate to an abuse of discretion of the trial court?
Well, I can't argue with the fact that the Court of Appeals doesn't specifically say in its judgment that it found an abuse of discretion. I can tell you that the Court of Appeals specifically found that the court erred relative to the signing bonus, and the only thing I can tell you is I can assume that the Court of Appeals understood the law that it was charged with in ascertaining whether or not the trial court made the right decision.
But doesn't it depend on the characterization of the property? I mean, we're talking about different ways of looking at the lease, different ways of looking at the signing bonus, and isn't that a matter for the trial court to handle in a domestic relations situation?
Well, yes, and in this case, yes and no. And the only reason I would say that is because we took out from the need of the court to decide issues virtually every single issue, virtually every single issue. And at the Court of Appeals, it was odd to me, and it was other counsel, that one of the things they kept arguing was, well, because we've paid her back for her premarital share, she doesn't get any of this. Well, we stipulated on multiple occasions, and prior counsel to me at the trial court level stipulated that certain payouts that were made during the pendency of the case were not to impact the arguments we make relative to the oil and gas signing bonus and to the royalties themselves. So I'm not sure if I'm answering your question, except that we do this all the time in any litigation, but primarily in domestic relations court, where we will take concerted effort with significant assets and try to eliminate them from the trial to save trial time.
So it almost sounds like you're saying this case really doesn't have general application for the future.
I think the Court of Appeals was right. I think that this is a property division issue. I think it's no different, except it's a novel topic. But if I was reading Justice Pfeiffer correctly, I think the Court of Appeals made the right decision. And I think that it's a normal decision relative to the division of property.
And there's nothing for us to write on?
Far be it for me to say I don't want to be a participant in a reported case. you know, the moment is not lost on me to be here before you and be quite honored to be here. Having said that, I'm not one to argue out of both sides of my face. I submitted in my brief in support of jurisdiction that I thought this was simply a property division issue. I think the Court of Appeals rectified it. I think we can go down a very slippery slope if we start discussing this. I hate that phrase, but it really could open up some things in different areas of the law that we may not anticipate. I know my time's up, but if I can answer your question, one of the things that struck me is, how are we going to handle property division in cases just like this? But let's suppose for a moment, instead of Gulfport essentially telling us what the property is worth with the lease rights, let's suppose no money had been paid, and Mr. Kuhn had kept this property. My client's going to get paid out of the fair market value of the property. You're going to get an appraisal. Well, what appraisal are you going to get now? Are you going to get an appraisal that says, well, putatively, it's the value of the land and the house, but now we have to consider putatively what would some phantom oil company pay me for my lease rights if I haven't been leased up? So now are we going to have parties that keep the house going to try out to peel off of that fair market value, this putative, unspecified potential oil and gas value to this marital residence? I actually didn't discuss it in my brief because I think we all like to think that we flesh everything out at the trial level and at the Court of Appeals level, but once in a while when you're staring at the ceiling in the middle of the night thinking about these things, these ideas come to you. But it really is, could result in some really odd circumstances. You know, we are losing the oil and gas business as we speak. I don't think it's tough to read the paper and know that a lot of land's leased up. Price of oil's gone down, no one's pumping, there's not even a pad on this property, so nobody's even contemplating pumping here right now, which was another issue with the royalties. But I think, yes, I'm not going to be disingenuous. I'm not sure there's anything to write
Thank
about.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel, you've used your time. You may take 30 seconds.
Okay. Thank you.
Pardon me?
Your Honor, just in response very quickly then to counsel's arguments and the questions that were posed as far as whether there was a determination if this was marital property or not. Counsel had indicated, there were many stipulations that were entered into by the parties, and so the trial court decision, I don't believe, specifically states the Hot Road property, was marital. However, I believe it was implied through the decision that was reached, because she then goes into the question of this transmutation issue by virtue of the various payments that were made by appellee towards the real estate, and then she found that no transmutation had occurred because they were able to trace all of the monies that were paid by her and then fully reimburse her. At that point, the property is then separate property of the appellant, and the question then becomes the signing bonus, whether it's an active or a passive income.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll take the matter under advisement. You'll be notified of our decision. Marshall, will you call a recess?